This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this lovely Saturday morning, September 7th, and football season has begun. And we are in the midst of the local college season. Later on today, I will be at the Coast Guard Academy for their kickoff, and my daughter Stephanie is at UConn covering their home game against Merrimack. So we have a lot of action going on there. And this is a show that I've been looking forward to because we have as our guest today Dr. David Banik. Dr. Banik, as many of you know, is a frequent guest on our show. He's an associate professor of medicine and head of the infection prevention program at the University of Connecticut. And we have a lot to talk to him about, right? COVID is coming up. We've just gotten through a summer wave, influenza. And then we're hearing more and more about Triple E, Eastern Equine Encephalitis, Western Equine Encephalitis. And many of your questions have been coming in regarding COVID, when to get the new vaccine, when is it available, can you get COVID vaccine with the influenza vaccine. So we're going to ask him all of those questions since he is clearly the expert on that. This day in medicine, September 7th, 1888, Edith Eleanor McLean was born in New York City. She was 2 pounds, 7 ounces, and she was the first baby and first infant in this country to use an incubator in what they called at that time a hatching cradle. And basically, we all have heard about incubators. We've probably all had family members who have had to be in an incubator, but these incubators are really designed as a controlled environment while allowing the human organs to mature and grow. So in the case of Edith Eleanor McLean, she was the first person to be put in one of these. In following up a little bit, there's not a lot known about her except one of her grandchildren wrote that she lived a very long life and had 12 children of her own. So she had a very productive life as a result of the use of that incubator. And that incubator was first brought to America and put together by Dr. Martin Cooney. Now, Dr. Cooney was an American obstetrician, but he's actually from Poland. He's of German-Jewish descent, and he was actually born with the name of Martin Cohen and had changed his name. And he became famous because he created what he called the infantorium. And in order to exhibit it, to get people to know it at that time in the 1880s, he would bring it with an infant to Coney Island to exhibit so he could show people what the technology was. Even at that time, it's credited with saving approximately 6,500 lives of infants who were born prematurely. So we remember Edith Eleanor McLean today, and the first person to live with the use of an incubator. As I mentioned, it's football season, and I spend a lot of time chatting about and seeing patients with concussion. One of the tools that's commonly used is something called the SCAT. It is the Sideline Concussion Assessment Tool. And basically, it's a series of questions and skills that have to be performed that can hopefully let someone know that they've had a concussion. So basically, athletic trainers use it. Medical personnel on the sideline will use this tool to make a diagnosis. A recent paper that was just published in the Journal of the American Medical Association looked at 92 NCAA football players, well, athletes, but most of them were football players, and compared it to 92 age-matched non-concussed teammates. So basically, those who had a definite concussion and those who did not have a concussion. And what they found is, after completing the screening tool, that there was no significant difference in the baseline scores of the athletes with and without concussion. So the tool is somewhat unreliable, as most of these tools are. Most of them are designed for research more than anything and for protocols. Concussion is a clinical diagnosis. It really requires a trained medical person to evaluate the patient, because it cannot be based simply on a test. There's no blood test. You have to look for the signs, the symptoms, the clinical findings. I rely a great deal on video. Everybody has video now. They tape all the practices. They tape all the games. And it's quite easy to obtain video. The athlete typically will have it with them, and it's provided by the athletic trainer. So we get an idea of the actual incident and how the athlete behaved afterward. Were they staggering when they got up? What were they like on the sideline immediately after? Did they have a loss of consciousness? So those are the things we look for. Well, one of the questions that came up and I wanted to touch on was that of stiff person syndrome. This is a rare syndrome. It's an autosomal recessive problem, and it typically occurs in people who are between their ages of 40 and 50. And basically, it's autoimmune. The antibodies block the glutamic acid decarboxylase enzyme. And basically, by blocking this enzyme, it blocks the production of GABA, which is gamma-aminobutyric acid. To make it so, and I misspoke there, it is not a genetic condition. It's autoimmune, not autosomal recessive. But GABA is the chemical that allows us to relax our muscles. And without it, muscles become stiff, they start to contract and go into spasm. So in these patients, they spontaneously develop spasm of voluntary muscles. And with that, it is a very painful condition. Fortunately, it's relatively rare, and there is no cure. There is symptomatic treatment for it. You know, what I think we're going to do is, when we get our good friend Dr. Bernardo Rodriguez back on the show, I think we'll put this on one of the topics, because he directly treats patients for this. It is a movement disorder of a type. Anyhow, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to get right back into it with Dr. David Banik. As I mentioned, Dr. Banik, a frequent guest on this show, is an associate professor of medicine. He specializes in infectious diseases. If you have questions for Dr. Banik, you can email me live on the program at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have as my guest today Dr. David Banik. Dr. Banik is a specialist in infectious diseases, and he always comes on our program with great information regarding infectious diseases and influenza and COVID. David, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Dr. Alessi. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with some of the things we've been hearing about. What I want to do is catch up on a few things, and then what we're going to do, maybe the whole second half hour we'll spend on COVID. But we've been hearing a lot about Eastern equine encephalitis. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Eastern equine encephalitis, it's also called Triple E, has been in the news recently. So it's a mosquito-transmitted infection. And you know, we tend to see it around this time of year here in Connecticut. It's an infection that can lead to a varying spectrum of illness. Sometimes it can be a milder illness with some fever, and but in certain severe cases, it can lead to confusion and hospitalization, much more severe. So it's variable. This is the time of year that we see it. Fortunately, it's quite rare in the grand scheme of things. So I think it's something to be aware of, but I don't think in terms of the overall risk, it's a very frequent thing that we'll see here. And typically we see it until the first frost when the mosquitoes kind of go away here in Connecticut. But something that's on the radar, I think, when it comes to protecting yourself, really mosquito repellent is probably your best option when you're going to be outdoors.
Have we had any cases here?
No, there was a case in Massachusetts that got some attention. But we do periodically see cases here in Connecticut. Again, quite infrequent, but something that's on the radar in sort of late summer, early fall.
How about Western equine encephalitis?
Yeah, so there's a few different viral encephalitis that we see throughout the U.S. West Nile virus is probably the most common that we see here in the Northeast. But there's varying mosquito-borne encephalitis that is on the radar. Similar symptoms, kind of a wide variety of illness that we see, but something that we're always keeping an eye on here in Connecticut and in the Northeast.
When do you usually see West Nile virus? Is this the same time as we see other mosquito-borne illnesses?
Yeah, typically summer and early fall is the time period that we see these mosquito-borne illnesses in the Northeast. Again, we're kind of waiting for that first frost, which is when the mosquito population really dwindles here in the Northeast. But this is the time of year, and something that, at least in clinical medicine and infectious disease, we've got our eye on.
Okay. Recently, we've had an outbreak of Listeria monocytogenes, a foodborne bacterial infection. How does this happen? I mean, in this day and age, with all the precautions we take regarding food, how do we get a foodborne illness like this?
Yeah, Listeria, unfortunately, we do see cases crop up related to foodborne illnesses. I think this most recent outbreak has been largely linked to deli meat from a particular company, Boar's Head, and specific lots of meat that were contaminated. And I think from what I've seen, they did investigations of the plant where the meat came from and found that the conditions there were suboptimal. But we do see this periodically. I've seen it linked to produce. Deli meat is kind of the big one that often gets implicated in Listeria infections. I think we've got a lot of measures to protect the food supply, but, sometimes we do see these infections occur.
9 people died from this outbreak. I mean, how does someone go about dying from this? Is it because of profuse dehydration, or how does someone die from a foodborne illness?
Yeah, in terms of Listeria, in sort of the general population, it tends to cause more of a diarrheal illness, and dehydration would be the big factor. But in certain groups, particularly immunocompromised individuals, older individuals, I think I saw, unfortunately, that the people who died did tend to be on the older side. Pregnant women are the groups that we see that tend to get more severe infections. They can get invasive infections, Listeria getting into the blood and even, causing meningitis in rare situations, and those are the ones that have the mortality associated with them. So, I think in the general population, without immunocompromise, illnesses tend to be milder, but it's those groups that are more vulnerable where we see, sicker infections and unfortunately mortality.
Next up, we have thousands of people dying from Mpox in Africa. Can you tell us about Mpox, and is it something we need to be concerned about here?
So Mpox, you may recall a couple of years ago, this was really on the radar, it as originally termed monkeypox and then now changed to Mpox. We've seen it circulate here in the U.S. There's a couple of different what we call clades. They're kind of like different strains of Mpox. Here in the U.S., the main clade that we've seen circulating is clade 2, and that has generally been associated with a milder illness. Typically some skin lesions and some fever associated with it. But this clade 1 seems to be circulating in Africa and causing much more severe illness. Again, we haven't seen that circulating here in the U.S. at this point, and it's something that's definitely on the radar. But you know, that seems to be the real concern and what's leading to like really severe illness and some mortality in countries in Africa. But, you know, it's one of those things we got to keep an eye on. And, you know, if we start to see more severe cases of Mpox here in the U.S., you know, we'll have to sort of respond accordingly.
But we have a good vaccine for Mpox, correct?
We do. Yeah, we do. And that's fortunate. You know, here in the U.S., you know, we have a vaccine that's been available now for the last couple of years. You know, it's, we've been providing it to groups that are at higher risk. In Africa, unfortunately, their vaccine access has been pretty limited until recently. I think the WHO really helped support a big push to get vaccine access in Africa where the outbreak is occurring. So hopefully, you know, that'll be what's needed to kind of quell the current outbreak that we're seeing there. You know, I think getting vaccine access in parts of the world where it's circulating is critical.
Something we will undoubtedly see here is respiratory syncytial virus. Now, last year, many of us went out and got vaccinated for that. Is that something we have to do annually?
So at this point, RSV is currently recommended as a one-time vaccine. I think there's ongoing study to determine if the vaccine protection wanes over time, and that may lead to a recommendation for a booster or repeat vaccination in the future. But at this point, you know, the recommendation is for individuals, you know, particularly older individuals that are more at risk, to get a single-dose vaccine. But stay tuned on whether boosters are going to be needed.
Will we be seeing it again? I mean, the numbers were up last year. Are we going to see that again this year?
It's always difficult to predict what's happening to respiratory viruses. And, you know, the COVID pandemic really, you know, kind of reshifted all of our thinking in terms of seasonality of these. But I do expect we'll see RSV circulating. You know, typically we see it in the winter. You know, usually like November, December-ish is when it starts to kind of ramp up. You may recall a couple of years ago, there were really high levels of RSV in the pediatric population that led to a lot of challenges in pediatric healthcare. But, you know, I think it's always difficult to predict, but I think bottom line is really, you know, those folks who are at risk, you know, can benefit from the vaccine, and you know, that's going to be what's needed to protect in the coming season.
In the last minute before the break, anything other than COVID that we should be particularly mindful of this fall?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the seasonal respiratory viruses, you know, even though we've seen the, you know, the quote seasonality changing a little bit, you know, we still expect that in the wintertime we're going to see them. So influenza, we could talk about that in a little bit more detail next segment. And then other respiratory viruses, too, you know, tend to show themselves in the winter. So, you know, I think we should be on the lookout for those. You know, it's going to be difficult to predict how much it's going to impact the community and healthcare settings. But, you know, something that I think should be on the radar for the coming months.
All right. We're going to take a short break. Now, if you have questions regarding COVID or influenza or vaccines, you can reach out to me at info@alessimd.com. I'm happy to share those with Dr. Banik, who will be returning as our guest for the next half hour. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it's great to have as my guest today, Dr. David Banik. And we're going to be talking about COVID. David, so we're just getting out of, I guess, what we would call a summer wave of COVID. What caused this summer wave? And is COVID going to be with us year-round, or is it seasonal? What do we know about it and its behavior?
So I think you know, there's still a lot that we're learning about COVID. You know, it seems to be tracking a little bit differently than what we see with other seasonal viruses. You know, this past summer we did see a pretty significant number of infections, you know, here in Connecticut and throughout the U.S. But, you know, I think, you know, it's still a little unclear what the future is going to hold. You know, I think we're seeing, you know, some different variants that are circulating. They seem to be circulating pretty readily. And, you know, we're seeing varying waning of immunity in the population. So, you know, I think we're going to keep learning about COVID. I think it's going to be here with us. And In terms of what the spread pattern is going to look like, it may be variable from year to year. But, I think it's something that in the coming months and years, we're going to learn more and, try to get a hold of what the circulation is going to look like.
A lot of what people have said is that it's gotten weaker. The symptoms are much more mild. Is that because we've built up some immunity, or is the virus itself weakening in its strength?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. That I think still we're looking to get a little bit more clarity on that. I think the protective immunity is definitely playing a part of this. We've seen now. Probably almost all, if not all, the population has some protective immunity from vaccination or infection or both. And, I think that is leading to an overall trend towards milder illness. Now, whether the variants themselves are milder, that may be possible too. And I think it's a little hard to tease that out exactly. But, certainly we're in a different place than we were back in 2020 in terms of severity of illness. But, we still, especially in folks that have underlying medical conditions that put them at risk, immunocompromised individuals. We're seeing some severe cases. I think, time will tell in terms of how things are going to evolve with COVID.
What do those severe cases look like? Are they still severe respiratory illness? And who are we seeing it in? Is it mostly, the elderly, as you mentioned, but people who are not vaccinated? What's the typical person there?
Yeah, I think, in terms of who gets hospitalized for COVID infection, it tends to be older individuals, immunocompromised individuals. Unvaccinated is a little difficult to tease out because, so many people at this point have had COVID. I think what we see more is in older individuals, in immunocompromised individuals, any protection from vaccine or from prior infection kind of wanes a little bit quicker than in the younger population. Severe respiratory infections, we're still seeing it in those more vulnerable populations. I think that's the group that we really have to be most attentive to when it comes to preventive measures like boosting and vaccination.
I think this is a good time for a question I had from Rob, and that is, in his case, he's been vaccinated and is up to date on all the vaccinations, but obviously has not had a vaccination since last year, since last October. So does he still have some immunity, or is it worn off? Because we're hearing about the different types, right? The different COVID types. I think we're on a KP type now, Omicron, things like that. So is someone who was vaccinated last October for a particular variant still have some immunity today?
Yeah, I think that, it's difficult to answer that question because it's probably variable from person to person, but there probably is some waning over the year that occurs. And the vaccines, and we can talk more about the updated COVID vaccines that are just becoming available now, are a little bit more targeted towards that KP2 strain that you had alluded to earlier, which is a main strain that we had seen circulating. I think for those higher risk groups, particularly older individuals, the updated booster becoming available is a way to kind of bolster that immunity going into the winter months.
Another question that came in from Mary, and this is regarding treatment for COVID. So are we still using, I know we're still using them, but the antivirals, Paxlovid in particular, is it effective?
We definitely are still using it. So we have Paxlovid as the primary outpatient treatment, and then we have Remdesivir, which we're using as the antiviral for inpatients. They are still available. They are still indicated, particularly for folks at higher risk or with more severe illness. In terms of the efficacy, I think this is something that still remains an area of study. What is the incremental benefit of these medications in light of people that have protective immunity from prior infections. I think we'll still learn more about this and over time, and this is something that I think we need to study. But right now, still recommendation for folks, particularly the more vulnerable folks, to get antiviral medications to try to prevent severe illness and infection.
Did we ever tease out the theory and the thought about Paxlovid rebound? What was that?
So, yeah, I think, you know, we're still trying to get a better understanding of that. I think in some populations that had particularly high, like, levels of virus, that Paxlovid was seemed to be effective in reducing viral levels, viral burden. After stopping, there seemed to be some rebound. But, you know, in terms of understanding, like, who is at risk for getting rebound, you know, what are the actual, like, implications clinically of rebound? Yeah, I still think that's going to be an area that we're trying to get a better handle on in you know, the coming months and years.
So here's where we get a little bit of overlap, and I wanted to bring in the flu vaccine as well. Well, let's talk about vaccines in general. With the COVID vaccine, who should be getting it now? Is it just for older individuals, young people, people susceptible, or should everybody be getting the new vaccine when it's available?
So, you know, I think, you know, the CDC has been a little nonspecific in terms of the recommendations. You know, it's kind of a general recommendation that if you're 2 months out from your last infection, you're eligible for the updated vaccine. You know, when I think about how to prioritize it, you know, I really think that those individuals who are older, you know, those individuals who are, you know, compromised, and particularly those individuals that haven't had COVID recently, would be the main ones to think about. You know, there's, I think there still is some protective immunity, at least in the short term, from having a recent COVID infection. So, you know, bearing in mind that this past summer, a lot of people had COVID, there's probably some protection from that. But, you know, those higher risk groups, I think, would be the priority for vaccination. But, you know, I think the general recommendation is going to be quite broad in terms of who is eligible to get a vaccine.
Okay. But now, obviously, we've been getting vaccinated for flu for a while. One question I had from Pat was, for the flu vaccine, should you be timing that vaccine? So some people like to try to get it late, like wait till October rather than September, so they might have more immunity later in the year in case it comes in March. Is it worth doing that, or should you just get it when it's available?
Good question. You know, I think, you know, the general recommendation is usually to aim for end of October. And past years, that's been the CDC stance. You know, it's almost impossible to predict exactly when flu is going to peak. But, you know, I think targeting that is probably a good move in terms of getting sustained protection, at least in the subsequent months. You know, I think that's what people should be thinking when it comes to the timing for vaccine. But, you know, I would say if you think you're going to have trouble getting the vaccine later in October and it's available to you now, you know, getting a vaccine now is preferable to getting no vaccine. I mean, that's kind of general thinking when it comes to timing. But when it comes down to it, it's really impossible to predict the perfect timing. But aiming for the end of October, I think, is a good guide.
Should you get the COVID vaccine and the flu vaccine at the same time?
So you can get both together. You know, I think in terms of the immune system impact, you know, we haven't seen a negative effect of doing that. You know, some people prefer to spread them out in case they get some symptoms after getting vaccinated for either. And that's reasonable, too. But you know, right now the CDC supports getting both together, and there doesn't seem to be a deleterious effect of doing that.
Do we have or will we have a combined vaccine of COVID and influenza?
Good question. You know, something that I know that I've heard that pharmaceutical companies are working on. It seems like logistically that would be a nice option to offer that. And you know, we have the technology to be able to do that with the current vaccine types that are available. But right now, there doesn't seem one that's going to be imminently available. But stay tuned. You know, maybe something that we see down the road.
Here was a question I had from Will, and this was about the use of N95 masks. He became aware that he was going to a doctor's office where they did require masks, much like I do, actually, when I see patients. But they said that they would not use an N95 mask because there were counterfeit masks on the market that were not effective. Have you heard anything about that in response to Will?
You know, interesting question. There are definitely masks of varying quality that are available. In terms of counterfeit, I think it's something to be on the lookout for. I think there's now, it's a whole different space than we were a couple years ago in terms of mask availability, particularly like KN95 and N95. So I think, my guidance would be to try to look for a quality mask. And if you're going to be wearing a mask, one that seems to be coming from like a reliable source. I think that's probably your best option to ensure that you're getting, some protection from it.
Switching gears again, in terms of the actual vaccines, how are they being made now? Are we still using messenger RNA vaccines? Have we changed the technology? Where are we at with the technology behind these COVID vaccines?
So there's a couple options. So, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are still available, and they use the mRNA technology. And now Novavax also uses a more traditional type of vaccine approach. And my understanding is that the Novavax vaccine it's going to be updated for more recent circulating variants and should be available soon. I think at the moment, just the Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna vaccines are available, but Novavax is anticipating that their vaccine will be available too in the coming months.
What's the status on the Novavax vaccine? Because that's different than the others. Is it better, worse? What are the pros and cons on going with that?
Yeah, I think I don't think we've seen data to demonstrate that it's significantly different than the mRNA vaccines in terms of efficacy and tolerability. It uses a more traditional vaccine technology, some folks may elect to get that, and I think that's reasonable. But in terms of effectiveness, durability of protection, we aren't seeing a significant difference amongst the different vaccine options. So it's available, I think some people may prefer to get that, especially if they've gotten in the past and have tolerated well and done well. I think it's out there, and it's certainly a viable option for folks looking to get an updated vaccine.
When it comes to the flu vaccine, are we recommending that for everyone now?
Yeah, the CDC recommendation is broad, so anyone over 6 months is recommended to get an annual flu vaccine. That flu vaccine, now the technology has been around for decades, and based on the data supporting effectiveness and tolerability side effects, it's now a universal recommendation for vaccine.
Here's something that puzzles me, and that is, in order to create the vaccine, right, you've got to have at least several months of lead time to try to be able to predict what the variant is going to be, whether it be for influenza or for COVID. How do they do that? How do they come up with those estimates in order to go in and create an effective vaccine?
It's interesting. They try to make predictions based on both what's been circulating in the last flu season, but also, we can look to what happens in the Southern Hemisphere when their influenza season tends to be more severe in our spring, summer. So we can see what flu strains are circulating in what our early spring, which is their early winter, which can help provide some insight into what to expect here. But it's never perfect. It's sort of the best estimate on what we're going to see here. That we try to make when we're developing the vaccines.
We talked about trying to time the influenza vaccine, but what about the COVID vaccine? Is it worth timing that? And is it available now, the new COVID vaccine? I don't even know if it is.
So it is available. I think the retail pharmacies just started stocking it like in the last couple of weeks. Other hospitals like UConn, we now just started having it available very recently in the recent days. So it is available. Timing, I think, is real challenging. I think some factors that you may want to take into consideration is whether you've had COVID recently. So if you've had a recent COVID infection, that may be a rational reason to wait a little bit. But in terms of, you know, when we're going to see COVID rates spike again, you know, I think that's becoming very difficult to predict. You know, based on past years, it's been usually, you know, December, January, but, you know, I think, you know, that may be a rough guess, but it's going to be difficult to time that perfectly. So I think I'd go based on if you've had COVID and or if you've had a vaccine recently, then you know, waiting a little bit might be a reasonable option too.
But if you haven't had the vaccine, I think many of us have probably not had a vaccine, a vaccination. Well, I guess I had one in March, right? It was a booster that was recommended, so I got it in March. You would just get it any time now in the fall?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. It's, you know, like I said, it's impossible to predict exactly like when you're going to get optimal protection, when rates are going to spike. But yeah, I think most people are looking at the fall as the timing to get the vaccine if you haven't had one in a year.
So let's talk a little bit about that booster. So, you know, I'm vaccinated in September, like many people, and then there was a recommendation to get another booster in March. Is that going to be common practice, or are we on the verge of maybe a longer-term vaccine that won't be an annual visit, maybe the last 3 years or so?
Yeah, that is a great question, and I don't think we know the answer. You know, with COVID, we're in some ways, you know, getting more information as we move along with understanding immunity, and we have you know, studies that are out there tracking people's, you know, protection in terms of antibody waning and, you know, immune protection over time. You know, I think that's something we're going to stay tuned and, you know, we'll learn more about in the coming months and years in terms of the frequency of vaccination, particularly in, you know, the older populations and more at-risk populations.
So do you think we'll need another booster in the spring?
I don't know. I don't think there's been any formal assessment on that. You know, CDC and FDA will probably regroup in the winter and kind of get an assessment as to where things stand and make a more formal recommendation on any subsequent boosters.
If you had a crystal ball, what would you think this year is going to look like in terms of COVID?
Oh, goodness. Difficult to really predict that. You know, I think the things we're looking at are, you know, what are the circulating variants and what is, how are they different than what we saw in the summer? You know, one concept might be that maybe because we saw a spike of COVID over the summer, that some folks that had COVID will have some protective immunity going into the winter, and maybe that'll give a more optimistic look in terms of you know, what we're going to see. But it's always difficult to predict that. So I'm not going to make any firm predictions by any means on what to expect. But, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, the protective measures are the same, you know, vaccine. And, you know, there's some additional measures like masking. And I think that's what we'll have to have on our minds moving into the winter.
I got to switch gears on you because I got a question from Michael. Here's a quick one. He states that he recently had a bad infection with zoster, shingles, and had not received the vaccine. When can he receive the vaccine after having shingles?
Good question. You know, I think as long as you're recovered from the shingles episode, you're eligible to get vaccine. You know, there's probably some protection in the short term. Yeah, I think the key would be the recovery of from infection would be the point at which eligibility would start.
Okay, so it's not like after you recover, wait 3 months or 2 months or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, you're eligible to get it right away. You know, whether there's some protection from having the recent episode, possible. But I think there's no like formal like window period that I'm aware of that you need to you know, wait.
Okay, and I understand the federal government is giving out free tests again for COVID, so people should stock up on those.
Yeah, those are that program I think just started a few weeks ago, where the government, now you can get, I think, 4 free tests sent in. And yeah, I don't know how long that's going to last for, but if you're interested in getting tests, yeah, I think that's still available now and to get ordered online.
David, thank you for your time today. For anyone who needs to reach Dr. Bannick to schedule an appointment at UConn, his office number is 860-679-4225. David, thank you as always.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Lessing.
We're going to take a short break, then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to our guest today, Dr. David Bannick, and talking about infectious diseases and COVID. If you have other questions for me to get over to Dr. Bannick, you could reach me at info@alessimd.com. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board. And as always, Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, I have some athletic obligations. So we will have a taped program, and we'll replay an interview of interest to everybody. And as always, I'll be taking your questions during the week at info@alessimd.com. If you missed any part of today's programs or other programs, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast. That's downloaded free at Odyssey.com or Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.